Richard Spendlove, the legendary broadcaster, has joined me. And we're just talking about our mutual love of country and Western music.
Indeed, yeah, quite. Yes, I didn't realise that, until I read somewhere that, I was just telling you about it actually, that Farron Young and Johnny Cash apparently are very good friends, and after Farron died, apparently his ashes were interred in Johnny Cash's garden, so they tell me.
As you do. Let's go back to the very start.
Oh.
A railwayman for 35 years.
Yes.
How did that all come about?
Well, that was easy actually. I left school on the blessed day of release, which was the 23rd of July 1954. With no qualifications at all. Lady Bracknell would be proud of me, actually, completely ignorant. And anyway, I went to get a job as an apprentice electrician. And I got this job, and it was £1.50 a week as an apprentice. And when my father came in from work, he said, have you got a job yet? So I said, yes. So he said, well, how much is it paying? And I told him, and he said, well, and he pointed to a signal box upon a bank. And he said, if you go up there, I can get you a job for 42 and ninepence a week, which was 12 shillings, about 60 pence a week more. So, naturally, I took it.
And then, of course, retired at 50. Did you think you were just going to go and cut the grass or something?
Well, no, I didn't. It was a little bit iffy, really, because I had been hanging around the local radio station here for about 2 or 3 years doing news.
Right.
Actually, only news. I never wanted to do anything else except Stringer, if you know what Stringer is.
Yeah, yeah. I am old enough.
Well, there you go. Yeah, I wasn't going to say that. It would be rude. But anyway, I'd been doing that from 1983, which was the year after it started, and it was a little bit, and I worked on a Saturday morning show. I might add that for the first 18 months, I wasn't paid anything at all, including a 12-hour Christmas day. And eventually, the programme organiser at that time came in. We were in reception, actually, and he said, he walked by me, and never even paid any attention to me. He said, I want you to start your own show in October. And I looked around to see who he was talking to. You see, and it happened to be me. So I after several goes at him, none of which he was interested in, I sorted the idea out for a one-to-one interview programme, a bit like Parkinson, but nowhere near as good and on radio. And he said, well, you've got a six-week trial, which lasted for 156 consecutive weeks. I think they liked it. They never said so. And that was really the start of it, I suppose.
And the Saturday night programme was the longest continually running phone-in show in the UK. That's
apparently
amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. Nobody more amazed than I am, I might tell you. Yeah, I mean, that started. The interesting thing about that was, I suppose, the amusing thing was that when it started, it was decided that I was going to do this Saturday thing from 10 to midnight. And the assistant managing editor at that time, as I walked down the first night to the studio, and I was a bit scared. First live show, you see.
As you would be.
So anyway, he put his arm around my shoulder and he said, Richard, he said, don't be despondent if you don't get any calls for the first few weeks. I had 146 calls in the first 2 hours.
Oh, did you say something controversial?
No, I didn't. I just kept playing them 50s and 60s music, which they appeared, started with Danny and the Junior at the Hop, and played this for 2 hours. They loved it. Absolutely loved
You've
it.
You've always had a great rapport, though, with your listeners. Mm. I have to keep reminding myself to say listeners rather than viewers. But what do you think it is? Do you think it's just that you're really down to earth and easy to talk to?
The thing is, somebody once interviewed me about this, and they said that the thing with you is that when someone comes on and says to you, I'm short of money, or whatever, you've been there, haven't you? And I said, yes. I mean, I've known the time in the early 60s when certainly we couldn't have afforded to have bought a packet of cigarettes between us and this sort of thing for several days. So I know. I did upset her one night. A lady came on. She was a very elderly lady. She was in her late 80s and she was crying. And I said, what's the matter, my flower? And she said, well, I've been doing my sums. And she said, I've realised I can't afford to bury myself.
Oh, my
goodness. And I said, well, do you want to tell me how much you've got? So she said, yes. She said, I've got about £870. So I said, well, I'll give you some good advice. What's this? I said, go out on Monday and spend it. Because I said, they've never left anybody on the top yet. There was a hell of a row at work, but she was thrilled to piss. Never left anybody on the top yet, which is true, of course.
So. You also have a great rapport with in the afternoon shows with Christopher South.
Oh, yeah.
Don't you?
He's brilliant to work with. I mean, we've known each other for 50 years anyway, so it was easy. But the thing is that I don't know what it was between us. In fact, I'll probably see him again before long. But the programme started at, I think it was 3. And at 3 o'clock, we walked into the studio with nothing.
No idea.
Nothing
of what
at
you
all.
Were going to say.
And, you know, they'd be reading the news and it would come to 3 minutes past and we'd open the mics.
Yeah.
And that would go.
I mean, that is a rare talent because I would find that terrifying.
Well, the point I've always said is that once the mic's open, you don't really have a lot of option.
You've got to say something.
You've got to do something a bit fast. So we did it, and working with Chris was a dream.
Yeah.
It was a dream come true, and I honestly like to think that he probably felt the same.
Well, you could tell just listening to you, you liked each other.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
And then in 2000, you received MBE for service to regional local radio. That was a huge honour, wasn't it?
It was a massive, massive honour. There's no doubt about that at all. The listeners all the way through were so priceless to me.
Oh, but they've been so loyal to you, haven't
Absolutely.
They?
Absolutely. I'll give you one, in actual fact.
I hope they're listening today.
I hope so. Stay with this station. But I remember the night that the Saturday night started in 1989, March the 18th, a lady came on and she said she thought that we were related because we had the same name. We didn't, as it turned out. But she said, well, I shall listen to you. And the last night of my programme, her and her husband were still listening 28 years on.
Oh, my goodness.
I was still getting calls the last week or the last fortnight from people who'd listened the first night.
And the phone-in format, I mean, that's interesting. Did you ever get any completely unexpected comments?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is that you, aside from the one which messed everything up, which we either will or won't talk about, I don't really care, occasionally you get somebody on who was a bit too well-oiled.
Yeah.
And my view,
at that time of the night, yes.
Yeah, that's right. And my attitude to that was straight away, well, look, mate, you ain't staying, you're going, and switch them off.
Yeah.
Because the listeners would say, that's right, you did the right thing. You know, and that was the end of that.
You mentioned briefly there the little BBC episode after 28 years. I mean, how do you feel it all went wrong for you?
Well, I mean, it all went wrong because the BBC they left me alone. They did nothing. I mean, what actually, I'll tell you the entire story. It's been on Facebook anyway. But one night, it was just after Alexander, the sergeant, what's his name, had shot this terrorist, whatever. A listener came on at the beginning of the show and said, what is your view on this? Well, actually, my view on it was the total opposite to all the listeners, because I am against killing.
Right.
And certainly against capital punishment. That is, any one of 10,000 listeners will tell you that. And so I said, well, at the end of the programme, I will tell you what my view is, which was that he did wrong.
Mm.
I don't think another listener believed that or agreed with that. But anyway, at the end of towards the end of the programme, this woman came on and kicked up hell's delight because she claimed that I was supporting Alexander Blackman, which would have been, in any event, a categorical lie. I could not possibly, because it would have been against everything that I'd ever wanted to do, you know, ever thought about.
So you kind of felt that the BBC hung you out to dry?
Oh, no
that.
Doubt, because they, you know, she said. And I said, well, I'm not. But at the end of the programme, what I did, and this is what damaged everything, I forgot to make my view known. And so the BBC said, I'm libelled in no end of papers that I supported Alexander Blackman, and I most certainly would have died first. Mm. So it was a bit of a tragedy, really.
I think as well, it's, you know, I don't know how you've seen it. I mean, I've certainly seen it. It's the changing face of broadcasting, isn't it? It's very, very different from when I started with
and
the
me.
BBC
yeah.
100 years ago.
Yeah.
Right. Now, first of all, you've written and acted in Oh, Dr. Beeching with Dad's Army scriptwriter David Croft. Tell me a bit about that.
Oh, that was surprisingly easy, actually. I mean, I'd obviously worked on the railway for 35 years, so I'd got some stories in the back pocket, and I rang David. I knew David's home because I'd interviewed Jeff Holland some time before, and he'd given me David's number at home. So I rang him on Saturday morning and said to him, look, you don't know me, but I think I have an idea for a sitcom, and I'd like to see you sometime. I would like to talk to you sometime. So I said, talk to me now. So I spoke to him on the Saturday, and he said, can you come and see me on the Monday? So I said yes, and on Monday night he sent me back and he said, write me a 28-minute script and post it. So I came straight home about 10 minutes to five, wrote this script straight off the cuff, posted it to him, and the phone rang in the morning about 9:15. The incredibility of the postal service, incidentally. Yeah. Anyway, and he was laughing. He said, well, you certainly know how to write North Country humour. He said, can you come and see me tomorrow? This was Wednesday, I think, Tuesday.
That was the result, wasn't it?
On Friday, it was commissioned.
Wow.
It was commissioned on the Friday. And during the other interesting thing about it was that during the time that we were writing it, a few weeks in, I said to him, we need another character in this. So he said, why? I said, we need an inspector, a district inspector, as a foil between Jeff and Paul. So he said, do we? I said, oh, yeah. So he said, have you ever been a district inspector? So I said, yes. So he said, well, you better play him then, love. So that was my audition.
Ringing equity. And you also write monologues, some of which are put to music, and play the piano.
Yeah.
Very talented. What about a one-man show? Why don't you go and tour?
Did a lot.
Did you?
Did a lot in the 90s.
Right.
And the interesting thing, I can say this because there are people who will vouch for this, I never played to an empty seat.
Oh, that was very good.
And the best one was Walton on the Naze, where we put 440 people in on Saturday night.
Wow.
And it was smashing.
Yeah.
Actually, I mean, but again, yeah, it was easy. And the thing was that I did obviously charity nights as well. We raised about 30,000, I think. And obviously, I usually finished about a pocket with them because I had to buy flowers for the ladies. But the one-man shows, I always bought the venue and I risked it all and I took the change. And we did one at the Ipswich Town Hall and we came home that night about 1 o'clock in the morning. And we'd made, shall we say, a significant amount. So I said to my wife, do you want to go to Georgia and see Aretha and Mervyn? So she said, what? Well, I said, we've made enough tonight to go twice.
Oh.
So anyway, I rang them. We hadn't seen them since 1961. So I rang them and I said, do you fancy visitors in 36 hours? And she said, well, yeah. And we were there in 36 hours at Atlanta.
And you've been married for 40 years. You have to...
58.
58 years?
58 years
now. That must be an old biography I read.
Wait a minute. Yeah, 1960. What's that? That's 58 years in November.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and she's still there, you know. And
yeah,
bless her.
Putting up with you.
I don't know exactly. You may well say that.
What else do you do? What do you do in your spare time? When you have some spare time?
Well, until now, there never has been very much, actually, as a matter of fact. I mean, I
gardening, though, don't you?
Who's been telling you? I am the world's... I loathe gardening. You know, I never owned a spade until the last year, and I went and bought one because I'd got to get a tree root out, or my grandson had. And the first time he stuck it in the ground, it broke. So I had to go take it back and get another one. So I owned one spade when I was 57.
Do you watch TV or listen to radio?
Very little. If I do television, it needs to be either historical documentaries or possibly an historical series would be nice. So things like, there was a beautiful one called The Prince Regent, which Egan played the prince. It was brilliant. That sort of thing fascinates me.
And we're both Geminis, I've noticed.
Both Geminis, which means the cream of the crop.
Good people got to stick together,
absolutely,
you know.
Yeah, well.
So, your hopes for the future?
Well, I don't know now, because it's difficult to say. I went, after Cambridgeshire finished, I went to, Zach FM. But the listeners, for one reason or another...
It just seems to be the wrong choice of audience.
They were very, very good. There's no doubt they were very kind to me. But the listeners didn't get through in the same number. I mean, I was used to about 30 or 40 calls a night.
Yeah.
And
it's very hard to talk to yourself all night,
there's only so many ways you can say you're listening too. You know, so I really don't know. I mean, I want to do some more. And there are a couple of ideas. Well, one of them is an iron in the fire. I don't want to say too much about it at the moment.
Of course.
But one of them is an iron in the fire, and it will ally itself to broadcasting. Let's put it that way.
Is there one kind of moment that stands out for you in all those years? Is there one kind of defining moment that you think, oh, I wish I could do that interview again. I wish I could do that programme again. I wish I could have that conversation again.
Yeah, well, there are a lot. There's no doubt about that. And it would be very difficult to say one, I suppose. I think that probably the first one... One of the funniest things that ever happened to me, and I've never forgotten, we went into a supermarket in Saffron Walden about two years old. And if ever we went into a supermarket or anything, I always used to keep quiet, didn't say anything because of the voice. Anyway, this particular Bet said something to me, and I answered her. And there was a line of about 12 checkouts.
Mm.
And we were at the one this end. And this lady flicked her head up and she said, "It's you. Isn't it? It's you, isn't it?" And I said, "Yes, it." And we had to call at every checkout down this cellar. And I thought then, God, I've made it. That was probably a nice
big one. Time.
Yes.
Richard, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
My
it's
pleasure.
Been a pleasure.